Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Prospect Lives. Each month, our family of seven writers discuss their differing views of modern life for Prospect magazine. Spanning a wide section of society, their reflections provide a window into their particular worlds and an insight into how they navigate their way through the challenges life throws at them. This month, our writers are facing up to big challenges. OCD sufferer Sarah Collins is overcoming her phobia of sleeping alone, while Alice Garnett's experiences on the job market led her to question how Gen Z will survive another recession. Sheila has been reflecting on activism in the arts, while Mike Brayley discusses the different apprenticeships he's completed in his lifetime. But let's begin with Farmer Tom, who takes us on a tour of farming protests around the world.
Why are farmers protesting around the world? My media feeds are full of farmers blocking ports and piling up manure. Well, there's a common thread that unites them. They're frustrated with restrictive government legislation, rising costs and decreasing prices. But the battleground in each country also has its own distinctive slant. So, let's take a world tour. In India, farmers protested in 2020 against the government, calling for minimum price guarantees for their grain sales. Farmers in India were already struggling with low incomes and there was a high rate of suicides. Over 10,000 farmers and labourers committed suicide in 2020. The laws which they were protesting against were repealed in November 2021, but with other demands unfulfilled, protests began again on the 13th of February this year. In Germany, government policies to ban the use of the world's most widely used, and in my view wrongly contested, herbicide, glyphosate, have stirred protests. Removing access to this herbicide, one relied on by many regenerative farmers who are reducing diesel-hungry tillage, increases the need for fuel, which is itself increasing in price as tax discounts are removed for farmers. In France, a nation not unfamiliar with industrial action, protests flared up in January this year. The demonstrators found an impressive number of ways to cause a nuisance, from setting tyres ablaze to dumping manure in front of government buildings and spreading soil on highways. The protests were against red tape from both their own government and the EU, and ultimately brought senior ministers to visit farms and make concessions. Incidentally, when the UK was part of the EU, a senior member of the National Farmers Union told me that French farmers were a powerful force in Europe, who knew that when politicians saw tractor tyres on fire on the Champs-Élysées, they would take note. Spanish farmers held a huge rally on the 8th of February. "They're drowning us with all these regulations," one attendee said. This sentiment is echoed by Belgian farmers who are angry about low food prices reducing income. Polish farmers are objecting to the relaxing of import controls, allowing Ukrainian grain to flood the market, while the Greeks are angry about the lack of compensation they've received for losses from disaster and disease. The Romanians are furious about the low government compensation they've received for rising fuel prices, and Lithuanian farmers are protesting on a number of issues, including for a minimum above-cost price for milk. Very little has happened, however, in the UK, barring a meagre gathering of Scottish farmers and crofters objecting to a lack of political engagement with farmers during beaver reintroductions. Very little that was, until recently. On the 2nd of February, over 1,000 Welsh farmers gathered in Welsh Pool Market, frustrated by government plans to introduce constraints on holiday lets and to insist that 10% of farmland be covered by trees. Welsh government analysis says that this last policy alone would cost 5,500 jobs and cause a £200 million loss to farmers. In recent questioning, officials for the Welsh Government didn't seem to understand the decrease in land value when trees are planted, or have a plan to compensate farmers. It's not hard to feel sorry for farmers trying to protect their livelihood, steward their land and maintain their business when faced with challenges from their own government. In England, however, with the recent launch of the Sustainable Farming Incentive, environmental schemes generally seem to be fair. A Merseyside farmer and NFU Cereals board member asked farmers via social media, who would they swap places with in Europe? He was implying that English farmers are in a better position than their neighbours. However, a recent UK campaign group called No Farmers, No Food has attracted 57,500 followers on X. On the 9th of February, farmers caused traffic jams around the port of Dover protesting against cheap imports produced under lower standards. But perhaps we've learnt from the Just Stop Oil protesters that disrupting daily life for hard-working Britons is the fastest way to lose support. According to one survey, 2024 might be a year in which half of Britain's fruit and vegetable growers go bankrupt. So perhaps our protests are still to come.
For Sarah Collins, who suffers with OCD, sleepless nights beckon.
It's 4 a.m. in an unfamiliar house. I'm lying in bed listening to an episode of Josh Widdicombe and Rob Beckett's Parenting Hell podcast, even though I don't have children. It's playing so quietly that I have to strain my ears to hear it, in the hope that the effort will send me to sleep. I haven't slept a wink so far tonight, or the night before. I get up to go to the toilet and find the handle to the bedroom door is jammed and I can't get out of the room. I spend a good 5 minutes wrestling with it to no avail. I'm beyond tired, I'm deranged with exhaustion and frustration that my own anxious mind is keeping me from sleep. I hit breaking point and flop down onto the floor, sobbing like a baby. I moved into the flat 2 days before. It's a lovely old Victorian ground floor flat that my boyfriend and I were lucky to snag at the end of last year in what was clearly a quiet week on the rental market. The flat we were leaving was the kind of awful that you only get at the bottom of London's hellscape private rented sector. Covered in mould, a cinch on a building site, the property developer landlord had even installed a portaloo opposite our bedroom window. I should have been full of excitement to escape. And I was, until I realised that a prior arranged trip to Bolivia on the part of my boyfriend would mean I would spend the first 2 weeks in the new flat alone. I'm so afraid of sleeping alone that it borders on a phobia. Imaginary intruders, many of whom have marched straight into my head from any mildly perilous TV show or film I've watched over the past few years, are lining up, waiting to knock on my window or break down my door the second I'm left on my own. I've spent the last 15 years or so trying to avoid their phantom break-ins. When my parents went away for 2 weeks after I moved back from university, I went up to my sister's house in Sheffield and lingered in her spare room for as long as she would have me. But on this occasion, avoidance wasn't an option. I had to find a way to cope with my phobia. I considered begging one of my long-suffering friends to come over and live with me for 2 weeks, but although I historically am a high-maintenance friend, even I knew this was too outrageous an ask. Sarah, you're a 27-year-old independent woman, I told myself. You have to be able to do this. I experimented with positive psychology, pepping myself up for the challenge. I tried a mindfulness meditation app. I took all the usual advice, avoid scary movies, stressful TV, or true crime podcasts. I even delayed watching the final few episodes of BBC's The Traitors, in case the sights of the hooded figures of, spoiler alert, Paul, Harry, and Andrew, haunted me as I closed my eyes. None of it worked. I still ended up sobbing on the floor. But it turned out that this spike in my anxiety, rather than being evidence of my failure, was the beginning point of my progress towards acquiring what is, for most people, a basic adult life skill. With exposure, my fear began to slowly burn itself out. I got a few hours sleep the next night and a few more the one after that. I got used to the sounds of my new house, the gurgle of the pipes and the reassuring creak of the floorboards as my lovely new neighbours padded around upstairs. It was on my fifth night of sleeping alone, Thursday night, that I knew I'd made it as an adult, when I was awoken by a long, loud bang outside at 6 a.m. Instead of freezing up with fear, I calmly realised I'd forgotten that Friday was my new bin day and I was glad of the opportunity to nip outside and put mine out.
Sydney-based writer and sex worker Tilly Lawless is consumed by questions of motherhood.
My desire to have a child has fluctuated wildly over the last 15 years. At 15, I knew I wanted to have a child and was sure that I would someday. At 30, I think that I want to have a child, but I don't feel the same certainty that it will happen. As a lesbian, the spectre of accidental pregnancy didn't hover over me through my teens and 20s as it did for most of my friends. Pregnancy would, more than likely, require careful planning, and perhaps because of that, I've interrogated my reasoning all the more and taken note of the sources of the fluctuations. At the darkest points of my life, when alone and abandoned in the husk of a romantic relationship, or depressed and unable to see a reason to live, I've desperately wanted a child so that I would have someone to nurture and care for, and something to give my life meaning. At my highest points, I've also craved a child, but less frantically, instead with a sense of wanting to share the overflow of the good in my life with someone else. At my most infatuated, I have dreamed of having a child with the object of my affection, something created between us. A child would be a tangible sign of our love that we can nurture together. What concerns me is that in all of these motivations for having a child, the child is a vehicle for my own fulfillment. And I wonder if it is fair to snatch a soul out of nothingness to add something to my own life. We speak about the gift of life, but for much of my life, being alive has felt like a burden that I have been tasked with and that I did not seek, that I cannot opt out of without directly causing pain to others. I cannot assume that bringing someone into the world who wouldn't otherwise exist is an innately kind thing to do, or even a neutral one. I am more than prepared to take on the practical responsibilities of creation, but I cannot answer for the righteousness of the choice. Many of my friends who are mothers can't explain their desire to have a child, beyond it being something that they've always wanted, or else they offer reasons in the same realm as mine. Some speak of the ravages of colonization and the solemn obligation that they feel to keep their people going in the face of persecution. From a collectivist perspective, I understand the need to have children, to continue community and ensure the care of older generations. From an individualist perspective, I understand it too, in terms of gratifying your own desires in life. But I can't help tearing apart my own motivations and seeing them as self-gratification, wondering what the child would want, while simultaneously being aware that it is a privilege to even be able to consider and choose and contextualize. I ran into a friend of mine recently who was heavily pregnant, and I asked how it has been going for her. "Amazing," she answered. "I've let go of all my guilt around not being busy enough or not working enough, because I can lie around all day and still feel the most productive I've ever felt." I completely understood what she described. That has been one of the intoxicating draws of motherhood for me. The idea that I would be sacrificing myself to the serving of something greater than me, that I could stop thinking about myself and devote myself entirely to someone else, that any career ambition I was supposed to have could be left by the wayside, guilt-free. One could argue that the need to feel productive is a result of capitalism, and maybe the use of that word in particular is, but I think the drive itself comes from something far deeper and older, the need to find meaning in life. A raison d'être. Is it selfish to have a child because you want one, when the child is a possibly unwilling participant serving your desire, or is that the only way life should be continued, because the desire of the mother is paramount? I cannot make heads or tails of it, and so I have been saying to friends that I'll leave it all in God's hands as to whether I become a mother or not. Meaning I won't seek it out, and if it happens, it happens.
You can enjoy an upgraded digital experience with the new Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere, at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration plus podcasts, like the one you're listening to right now. And you can subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, which is available on iOS and Android.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Sheila Hancock is proud of the role her profession plays in holding the government to account.
The Tories' disparagement of the arts is demonstrated by their insulting recent choices for the Minister of Culture. Nadine Dorries left destruction in her wake and later threw a tantrum at not being sent to the House of Lords to further her ignorant political mayhem. The current one, Lucy Fraser, had launched a wearily familiar attack on the BBC, so ludicrously lacking in substance that when she was challenged in an interview, I actually felt sorry for her. It was along the lines of, the BBC is not impartial, it's biased against the Conservatives. And give me an example. Just one example. The next day, Mark Harper, the Transport Minister, no less, chipped in, advising us to consider a wickedly biased episode of the news quiz on BBC Radio 4, which at least he'd heard of, whereas I doubt our council lady knew of its existence. Hugh, not very merry man, recommended we listen to its shameful anti-Tory bias. Unfortunately for him, those of us who did were treated to one of the best episodes of the remnants of satirical programming left on the frightened BBC, of which the highlight was a hilariously vicious critique of Keir Starmer. Recent events have reminded politicians why they have reason to fear my profession. The appalling treatment of the sub-postmasters in the post office scandal with a plan unheeded but to the media's pressure over the years, culminating in an ITV drama that has roused the nation and forced politicians and bosses to take responsibility. It's strange that the establishment is so dismissive of culture. Television, film and theatre, both large-scale and fringe, are highly influential, as are sport, literature and music. I recently watched a documentary about the Beatles, which took me back to the late 1950s and early 1960s, when I was working in a super tacky theatre company, performing in the Tudor Cinema in West Kirby. One day, a local lad from a regional paper told me of these boys from a similar background to him and me, who were doing interesting things in a place called the Cavern, in nearby Liverpool. I was too exhausted doing awful plays to go with him to see them. He, Eric Taylor, ended up touring the world as their publicity supremo. In those days, anything was certainly possible for the lowly. All four boys of the original Beatles were very likable and from a respectable working-class family, which their lyrics reflected. Unlike some of today's artists, they showed respect and genuine love for women. They wore smart suits and tossed their well-cut hair about in pure joy. They were eager to learn and improve themselves and their music. So from humble beginnings, they became brilliant and progressive. They ended up abandoning what seemed like a glamorous life when it became formulaic and boring to them. They were talented, but quite ordinary. Yet the band was hugely influential, heralding the end of an era of deference and suppression and opening the door to the youth culture of the future. The image on television of a girl not listening to the music, but standing in a crowd, hysterically screaming, abandoning all semblance of ladylike behaviour, summed up the new, wild sense of freedom that frightened the grown-up. The documentary interviewed some people of colour in America, where the Beatles toured when segregation was still enforced in some states. There was a wonderful sequence when the boys are told about it and are not righteously angry, but completely bewildered. For the interviewees, a Beatles concert was their first mixed event. The boys insisted on no apartheid in their massive audiences. The thing about cultural activity is that it often entails gatherings. And when people get together, they communicate, whether it be children doing a workshop with classical musicians in a small classroom, or pop fans waving arms in unison at a vast festival. People being brought together start to stand up for themselves. I hope all my colleagues in television will continue to hold up a mirror to society, as they have done ever since Ken Loach and the opinion-changing telly of the 1960s. Despite the collapse of funding for the arts, I hope the abandoned musicians, dancers, actors and artists of all sorts will somehow hang on. We're in for a rocky ride, but new ways forward will be found. Culture will survive by being creative, while the establishment will shrivel if it keeps holding on to old beliefs and destructive rules. Lower taxes, stop the votes, stick to the plan. The British people want more than this hollow rhetoric. I hope that despite decimating cuts and government indifference, the arts will be there to provide the vision.
For Gen Z-er Alice Garnett, a new year means a hunt for a new job.
Two men sit before me. They ask me questions about why the last thing didn't work out and about my biggest failure and how I overcame it. No, this isn't a twisted first date. It's a job interview. It is 18 months since I last applied for a job and 1 week since I was given my notice at my previous position. I had barely come to terms with my redundancy, let alone the absolute art that is job applications. Of the 15 people I spoke to on Monday, only one of them had not been made redundant. This is a direct line from one of my interviewers, who said it, meaning well. But unfortunately, all I heard was, the competition is hotter than ever, and I barely have 2 years' experience to my name. I know I'm not the only one who entered 2024 without a job. We are living in a recession, after all. Bizarrely, one of my earliest memories is couched in the 2008 financial crash and ensuing economic shitshow. I remember sitting cross-legged on a sticky floor, looking up at a larger-than-life-sized image of Gordon Brown on a projector. I was huddled in a crowd of other children in assembly, who were just also about to unwittingly learn some hard economic truths. But until one gate crashes your personal life, there's nothing tangible about economic catastrophes. To the 8-year-old girl who sat in that crowded assembly hall, it all seemed rather abstract. Even as a 24-year-old woman, it still feels rather abstract. I'll be honest, if quizzed on it, I wouldn't be able to accurately define recession. To me, it just means more unemployment, less money floating about, something to do with house prices, and all in all, bad economic vibes. But I've never known any differently to this set of circumstances. I've never truly experienced an era of economic prosperity, and I've barely been privy to any period of stability either. Losing my job as a direct result of the shitty macroeconomic circumstances we find ourselves in has made the recession feel like a very real thing indeed. I was offered the position to wrap up my work with my former employer within a few days of being made redundant. They understood I needed time to move on and find my next gig, and so I had 4 fully paid weeks to land myself another job. Time was ticking, so I dove straight into the job hunt, trying not to think too hard about my extortionate London rent, our unreasonable energy bills, and the ever-increasing cost of just about everything. I begrudgingly updated my LinkedIn. Although I love publicising frivolous and arguably unsavoury parts of my life, I cannot stand making my professional achievements known to the world. Posting on LinkedIn would shatter the air of Gen Z irony and nonchalance I've worked so hard to cultivate. But needs must. I cast aside the part of me that shares my generation's general ambivalence towards the world of work. An anti-capitalist, anti-work mindset may keep us sane, but it will never pay the bills. I reconnect with my adolescent self, the girl who was laser-focused on smashing her A-levels, attending Oxford, and going on to become a corporate lawyer. And honestly, I barely know her. I'm well aware that I frequently bash productivity culture, hustling, and the millennial girl boss persona in this column. You see, online, much of my generation expresses contempt for work and office life. With the economic and environmental climates being as dire as they are, it's become unclear what we're supposed to be hustling our way towards. More and more young people, especially those who have opted for life in London, are giving up on the idea of home ownership before their careers have even begun. Then there's the woeful state of modern dating, and many feel that apps have made long-term commitment impossible, although I, an ardent commitment phobe, probably do exacerbate this problem. We're not saving up or scaling the career ladder in order to have families or buy houses. Working in mission-driven startups has helped me find purpose at work. I've worked in small companies as a part of a small team trying to achieve big things. Instead of focusing so closely on my own progress, my own professional development, I've always lent into the company mission. I don't care personally for working myself to the bone to get promotions, earn loads of money, and acquire social status. And I certainly don't care for LinkedIn. While it's important that companies create clear avenues for progression, something my various employers did well, I think it's as important for people to understand why the work they do is important, and how their work might be making the world a better place. Rather than moaning about Gen Z being lazy, work-shy, quiet quitters whose ambivalence towards work endangers productivity, maybe older generations should do a better job of giving us something to work towards. Because the majority of us aren't thinking about houses or babies. We're, by and large, worrying about the state of the world and how on earth we're going to live in it.
Former England cricket captain Mike Brearley celebrates the value of apprenticeships in sport and in every area of life.
In September 1960, before going to university, I got 3 weeks of work experience as a so-called carpenter's mate through one of the players in my father's cricket club, who worked as a manager on the job. The site was exceptional. Marlborough House in St James's, where the Queen Mother had lived until her death in 1953. It was being renovated in preparation for a lease to the Commonwealth Secretariat, as is still the arrangement today. The carpenters who worked on the house were of two types. The older, trade union craftsmen did delicate work, slowly, steadily, and skillfully repairing the sash windows in the grand reception rooms. They were conscious of hard-won rights and requirements, long apprenticeships, tea breaks, lunch breaks, pay rates that recognised seniority. They moaned as steadily as they worked, in drab London accents, much of it sotto voce. The other group were young men from Barbados, animated, energetic, patois-speaking. Predictably, the trade unionists had little time for them, contemptuous of their having, they intoned, recently arrived off a boat, untrained, with a hammer and a saw in a paper bag. The Bayesians were given minor routine jobs. I remember standing around helping them put up a full ceiling in a side room. They swarmed over the ceiling, animatedly talking in what was to me an incomprehensible accent. They were fun. Both sets of carpenters were in their own ways kind to, or at least tolerant of, me. The composition of the England cricket touring party to India this winter and the selection of the teams for the first two tests takes me back to this situation. The point of comparison is not about attitudes to race, but apprenticeships and seniority. The ultimate craftsman, Jimmy Anderson, has moments when he is not averse to a good moan, while the rest of the bowling attack has been raw and inexperienced. Tom Hartley, Rehan Ahmed and Shoaib Bashir have more than a saw and a hammer, but they don't have much more experience than the Bayesian carpenters. Hartley and Bashir were each playing in their first tests, with 20 and 6 first-class matches behind them. Ahmed had played in one test over a year before, in Pakistan, but only 13 first-class matches. I wonder what the bowlers of my playing days would have muttered had they witnessed such selections. Raymond Illingworth, say, or Fred Titmuss, I could name many more, had played 6 days a week for at least 5 months every year in long, two-innings-a-side matches, enduring a wide range of conditions over several seasons before being selected for England. I would have agreed with them that it takes time to learn the difficult trade of slow bowling. A test team, I would have thought, could barely accommodate one such inexperienced bowler, let alone two or three. Contrast the Indian team for the same matches. Two of their three spinners at Hyderabad, Ravichandran Ashwin and Ravindra Jadeja, had taken 500 test wickets between them in matches they had played together. In India, they had been especially dominant. The third, Akshar Patel, had played in 13 tests and 53 other first-class matches. When Jadeja was ruled out for the second match at Vishakhapatnam because of injury, they had Kuldeep Yadav to call on. He had already played in 8 tests and 34 four-day matches. And yet, the young England bowlers bravely stuck to their task. At Hyderabad, where England won an extraordinary match by 28 runs, it was the Indian spinners, with their vast experience, whose accuracy was challenged by bold, innovative batting. Ben Duckett, Ollie Pope and Joe Root were versatile and daring, but also skillful in the way they employed both more or less orthodox sweep strokes and reverse sweeps. Apparently perfect deliveries were dispatched in unusual directions. Fielders had to be placed to guard these boundaries, which meant that other positions were vacant, and the bowlers' lengths were disrupted, resulting in more half volleys and short balls than usual being bowled. When the turn of England's spinners came, they didn't face nearly as many unorthodox shots from India's batsmen, nor were they fazed by their own occasional errors, a number of full tosses and long hops. There were no signs of the yips, the panic that can sometimes set in and upset a bowler's consistency. Stokes's attitude was a major factor in the young England spinner's resilience. He gave debutant Hartley the new ball and kept him on for a long spell, despite an early pummeling from the talented Indian opener Yashav C. Jaiswal. Later, he persisted with Ahmed. In the second match, debutant Bashir got a long spell in the first innings. These bowlers are clearly both talented and confident. Hartley and Bashir are well over 6 feet tall, an advantage when it comes to getting bounce and bowling above average speed. What's more, neither seems to have lost the capacity that many shorter bowlers have, releasing the ball so that it goes up out of the hand above the batsman's eye line. For his part, Ahmed has strong shoulders and a bustling action, a reminder of Shane Warne, the greatest leg spinner ever. He puts energy into his deliveries. A last word about Hartley. He reminds me of the great Hedley Verity, Yorkshire and England bowler of the 1930s. He has an easy, high action, unforced and reliable. In 2 matches, he has taken 14 wickets. He bats and fields well too. His batting average is higher than his bowling average. He has a good temperament. He's learning fast. Athena, the Greek goddess, was born fully formed from the head of Zeus. Maybe Hartley can already repair sash windows.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Prospect Lives. Join us next month as we discover what trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs our writers have experienced. If you've enjoyed this episode of Prospect Lives, I'm sure you'll enjoy Media Confidential with me, Alan Rusbridger, alongside Niall Barber, who used to be my counterpart at the Financial Times. We take you behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait to uncover the real facts behind a story. A new episode is out every Thursday, so be sure to subscribe and follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. Prospect Lives is brought to you by Prospect Magazine and produced by Sarah Collins and Martin Points-Roberts for Fresh Air. Goodbye, stay safe, and see you next time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.